Welcome to the Flaster Greenberg Podcast. This is episode 1 for Friday, June 1st, 2007. Recent changes in the tax laws have created new gift opportunities and financial incentives for charitable giving. In this podcast, we present strategies for managing personal wealth through planned giving, a conversation about the implications of the new tax laws for planned giving and charitable donations. I'm your host, Steve Lubetkin. Hello and welcome. This podcast is brought to you by the law firm of Flaster Greenberg of Cherry Hill, on the web at flastergreenberg.com, and Isdaner & Company Certified Public Accountants, on the web at isdanerllc.com. Our speakers for this program are Ruth Tanner, CPA, of Isdaner & Company, and Michael Spiro of Flaster Greenberg. Ms. Tanner is in charge of the individual tax practice at Isdaner & Company, where she provides tax planning services to clients, including counseling on strategies for charitable giving, education funding, and retirement planning. She joined Isdaner & Company in 2000. Before joining the firm, she worked at two national accounting firms and also served as an internal audit manager for a major corporation. She has more than 20 years of experience. Her professional affiliations include treasurer and member of the Board of Trustees of the Women's Law Project, member of the Board of Directors of the Utility Emergency Services Fund, member of the Pennsylvania Institute of Certified Public Accountants, and the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Mr. Spiro, a member of the Taxation, Corporate, and Estate Planning Practice Groups at Flaster Greenberg, focuses his practice on providing advice in the areas of tax and business planning. His representation of clients focuses primarily on advising them about issues relating to personal estate planning and asset protection, structuring business transactions to maximize federal and state tax savings and efficiency, tax-efficient formation of businesses and choice of entity, employee benefits and executive compensation, and forming and maintaining tax-exempt entities. Mr. Spiro has written extensively on small business and individual tax issues. He's given presentations on asset protection planning for physicians as part of the Flaster Greenberg Physician Lecture Series and on using tax-exempt bonds for development for the South Jersey Builders League. Our presentation in this podcast was recorded May 22nd at the Pyramid Club in Philadelphia, and it runs about 1 hour.
My name is Michael Spiro. I am an attorney at Flaster Greenberg. We're a full-service law firm in throughout the Delaware Valley, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, concentrating primarily on business clients and individual clients. I'm a member of the tax and corporate group, and I do a lot of estates work as well. Just a couple of preliminary housekeeping things. Some of you may notice that I'm wired up. This is Steve Lubetkin, who I'd like to acknowledge, who is taping this for the live album, which will be available in record stores shortly. Actually, it's going to be a podcast. So for those of you who really enjoy the presentation, want to hear it again, you can probably find it on the Flaster Greenberg website or the Isdaner & Company website. So when you have questions, I'm going to ask that you raise your hand so that we can give you the microphone, which will not amplify your voice, but will put you on the internet, to the extent that you're comfortable with that. Before we get started, to introduce the topic, this is strategies for wealth management through planned giving. As most of you probably know, or you might not, the Pension Protection Act of 2006, which was primarily a pension and employee benefits bill, contained a lot of provisions concerning charitable gifts and created some new incentives and some exciting opportunities in charitable giving. I say exciting if you get excited about new tax laws like I do. Not everybody does. The thing to remember, and I think this applies to both Ruth's presentation, which will be coming up shortly, and my own, is that when you deal with charitable giving incentives, you still always need a charitable purpose. There's never going to be a charitable giving incentive so good that it makes it worth it to give to charity if that isn't your actual goal. A lot of clients will sometimes ask about charitable giving as a tax savings mechanism, which it is, if you have a charitable goal. And I think that's something that sometimes gets lost in these discussions of the tax benefits. But the key here is going to be structuring charitable gifts so that they are maximally efficient for tax purposes, but they're still charitable gifts, and at the end of the day, you are parting with some property and giving it to charity, and that's just something to kind of keep in the back of your mind. And with that, we can now go into the best ways to structure that so as to achieve maximum tax savings and to take advantage of all the opportunities that the law gives. And I'm going to turn it over to Ruth.
Good morning. Just going to give you a little bit of background about myself. I'm Ruth Tanner, and I'm a certified public accountant. I'm with Isdaner in Ballackinwood, and my primary responsibility is I manage our individual income tax practice. And we have over 1,300 individual income tax returns that we prepare. I'm also involved in tax planning with just not only the individual clients, but a lot of our client base is shareholders and partners of companies that we also do either the audit work or the tax work for the S-Corps and the partnerships. As Michael already mentioned, we're going to be giving some information regarding the Pension Protection Act of 2006 and various incentives for charitable giving. Like I said, the act was passed last August, and like most tax bills, there's some good news and there's some bad news. There are some charitable incentives, but they're taking some things away or making it harder to take tax deductions for contributions. Like I said, good news and bad news. Some of the good news is these incentives. Part of the bad news is right now that a lot of these provisions are going to expire at the end of 2007. I did read recently that there were bills introduced in Congress in March to try to extend these provisions, but here we are, it's almost June, and nothing has happened yet. But I don't know if some of you recall last year, at the end of the year, there was tax provisions that did a lot of other extensions, and that wasn't passed till like December 22nd. So there's still some leeway of time this year to give, and we'll just kind of have to see as the year goes on whether Congress decides to extend any of these provisions. One of the provisions that was just in the law, I'm going to talk about the old law and the new law, where there's a charitable contribution of your IRA. Prior to 2006, and then if, like I said, this is not extended in after 2007, when you take your distribution out of your IRA, it's fully taxable. It goes on your tax return. And what does that do? It increases your what we call your adjusted gross income. So it sets a lot of other limits on what you can deduct. It sets your normal charitable deductions, which is assuming it's not capital gain property, at 50% of your adjusted gross income. It also limits what we call your 2% miscellaneous itemized deductions. Hopefully everybody's healthy, but it also limits your medical expenditures. It also limits your personal exemption. So like I said, so by adding money to your AGI from your IRA distributions, it raises your taxable income. Well, this bill said, okay, we're going to have a provision that for 2006 and 2007, you can take that IRA distribution, and if you give it directly to a charity, you don't have to put it into income. But there's some catches right now. It doesn't work for everybody. You have to be at least 70 and a half when you give the gift. So let's say you're going to be 70 and a half December 29th. You can't do that this today. You've got to wait till you're 70 and a half, or they say, doesn't work, goes into your income. The maximum amount that you're allowed to give each year is $100,000. If you're married filing jointly and both your wife are 70 and a half, you could each give $100,000 and it goes right to the charity. And the IRA distribution, it's not reported as taxable income. And why is that important? Like I said, if you're not reporting as taxable income, it's not part of your AGI. Then when it lowers your AGI, it possibly helps you, like I said, get more of these 2% deductions. Your itemized deductions are also limited. 2006 and 2007, there's what they call this 3% scale down where it limits some of your itemized deductions. In 2006 and 2007, it's limited by 2%. If you're lowering your AGI, you can take more of these deductions. If you are 70 and a half, you're most likely receiving Social Security benefits. If you lower your AGI, then it's very possible that your Social Security benefits would not be taxable. Like I said, so there's a lot of reasons why you would want to have your AGI less. Also, when you have other contributions that are subject to either the 50% or the 30% limitations, if your AGI is lower, then you might be able to use some other carryovers that you weren't able to use before. Part of this also is you would have to be able to claim the charitable contribution as a gift if you weren't giving it as a direct contribution from your IRA. This means that if you give the gift to the charity, it can't be used to, like, you know, buy tickets for a benefit or for raffles. It has to be a qualified charitable deduction. Okay, and as I said before, you don't have to report this as income on your tax return. But one of the really important things with this is that when you give this gift, it has to go right from the IRA to the charity. You don't take the money out, put it in your bank account, write the charity a check, and then say, okay, I gave the charitable deduction. I don't get to take it as a charitable deduction on my Schedule A, but I don't have to pick up the income. It has to go right from the organization that's holding your IRA money directly to the charity. And it's really important that you also get a letter from the charity saying, we got this gift, because we found in some of our clients that did do this in 2006, the tax reporting document for IRAs is what they call a 1099-R, which shows how much money you pulled out of your plan. Because this is a short-term provision for 2006 and 2007, a lot of the companies that issued the 1099s didn't want to go change things, so it showed up as a taxable distribution on the 1099. So without us seeing a letter that it went right to the charity, then we could correctly report it on the person's tax return, showing that yes, you got a distribution of $100,000, but none of it's taxable. Like I said, so it's really important to get the letter to document that it went right to the charity, and also that the charity tells you that you received no goods or services for this, because that would disallow it as this qualified charitable deduction. The donor, you have to be at least 70 and a half when you make this contribution. I didn't cover. The distribution must be made from an IRA. I'm sure most of you are familiar that people have what they call SEP plans or simple plans or 401k plans. This does not apply. You cannot take the money from your 401k plan and take it as a qualified charitable distribution. It has to come from an IRA. But as a planning idea, you could open up a new IRA, take your money from some other qualified plan, move it to that, to the IRA, and then make this contribution. Like I said, because if you don't have an IRA, you could still set one up. The recipient organization has to be a public charity or a conduit private foundation. What this means is we have several clients that have their own private foundations. They are not allowed to take this IRA distribution, put it into their own private foundation, not put it into income. Like I said, you don't get the charitable deduction, but there's specific language in the law that says, no, you cannot do that. So it's really, it's mostly like normal public charities that people are doing this with. The payment would have to qualify for charitable deduction. Like I said, you can't, be getting raffle tickets or, 50 tickets to their annual gala event for doing this. It has to be a real charitable deduction, and that's why you need that letter. Like I say, and the distribution would otherwise be taxable, because if you weren't giving it directly to the charity, you would be putting this on your tax return as a taxable distribution from an IRA. Like I said, we've got a limited window of time right now, assuming you or some client of yours or someone that you're dealing with is going to be 70 and a half this year. I can't predict the future, so I don't know whether Congress will pass any bills to extend this. But one of the things in some of the bills that was introduced in March is not only are they trying to extend it beyond the end of 2007, they're trying to lower the age so it does. You don't have to be 70 and a half. You can take money out of an IRA once you're 59 and a half and not pay any prepayment penalties. And then they're also talking about maybe raising the threshold of the 100,000, but that's, like I said, very still much up in the air since nothing actually has been passed. The next topic that is giving an incentive for 2006, which was passed in 2007, is donations of real property for conservation purposes. What is the prior law? And I don't know how many people here have property that would qualify as conservation, but I want to make you aware of it because it is a tax benefit that is available in 2006 and 2007. In the prior law, if you gave conservation property to a qualified charity, you were limited to getting a deduction of 30% of your adjusted gross income. And if you couldn't use it all in the year that you gave the property, that contribution could be carried forward 5 years. So Congress decided, I guess there's a lot of conservation property out there, I'm not sure myself, but that we're going to give an incentive to donate qualified conservation property to charities. And what they're going to do is they're going to increase the percentage to 50% rather than 30%, and they're going to increase the contribution carry forward for 15 years. So like I said, you've got a lot of a time frame where you can still, if you can't use it all. So I'm going to give you an example. Let's say the taxpayer has adjusted gross income of $100,000 and he made a qualified conservation contribution of $80,000, which that's the fair market value of the property. Because his income was $100,000, his adjusted gross income, 50% of it would be $50,000. And he also gave $60,000 of cash contributions. In 2007, he would be able to take the $50,000 of cash contributions, and then the other $10,000 he can carry forward for five more years. He gave the conservation property in 2007. He didn't get to use it in 2007, the $80,000, but he can now carry that forward for 15 more years. Even though he didn't get the direct tax benefit in 2007, but if you don't make it by the end of 2007 and they don't change the law and extend this, you're going to go back to the 5 years. So that's it's if someone has this kind of property, this is the year to do it. Because like I said, even though you might not see that direct benefit today, 15 years is a long time. And the ordering rules would work it where in year two, you would use the $10,000 of the contributions that were cash to carry forward. And then let's say your adjusted gross income again was $100,000. You would be able to use $40,000 of that $80,000 in 2008. And the other $40,000 would be carried forward another, you know, for another 14 years. So it is a good tax plan if you have that kind of property or if you know someone that does and they wanted to give it away anyway. And that's the whole key here, as Michael said before. You have to want to be charitable. You know, savings taxes is wonderful, but if you don't want to give the money away to a charity, then all these changes in the law, whether we stay with them or they go back to the old law or they extend them, you have to want to give this money to the charity. And like I said, it has to be a qualified charity. Like I said, this conservation is really only good for the 2 years. Then a lot of people in the past have given gifts of what they call a fractional interest in tangible personal property. And mostly this is people giving artworks to museums, and they want the museum to have the painting or some sculpture. They charitable deduction laws. Now this is where we got not the good news. Like I said, the other two things with the conservation and the IRA rollovers to charity, that's good news. Those are incentives to give more money. And even though this is an incentive to give money, a painting to a museum, they're making it harder. Because in the year that you give the painting to the museum, you get it appraised, and the appraiser comes back with a value, let's say, of $1 million on the painting. And assuming it's capital gain property, it would be limited to 30% of your AGI. So you give the painting to the museum and you get to take $300,000 as a contribution that year. When you give future interest of the painting, before you could get it revalued and get a new market value, so now it's worth $5 million and it's 30%, then you could take 30% of that. Well, this law has changed that. You have to be looking at the market value when you gave it, $1 million. When you give more of the fractional interest of the property in future years, you are limited to that $1 million value. The painting went up to $10 million. That's the way it goes. You're only going to be able, let's say like you gave 25% the first time, then another 25% the next time. You're going to be limited to that market value of $1 million. Part of the bad news is if you die before you give the whole fractional interest, the rest of the fractional interest to the museum, when you die, you don't get that step-up basis in your estate. They don't look at the date of death value on that painting. They say you gave it the painting in 2007. It was worth $1 million. There's 75% left of that painting in your estate. You don't get the value to step it up. So like I said, so it could trigger some estate tax issues. There are also some limitations with this. It applies to, like I said, this is all for, this act was passed on August the 17th. So these are all passed after that. As I said, you have to value the interest in the property when you give it, and it sticks with that value for future. It provides recapture of tax benefits under circumstances. You have to give the rest of the gift within 10 years from the date of the original contribution. Unless you die before 10 years, then it goes to the museum, whoever you gave it to. And the museum, I'm using the example of the museum because mostly this is artwork. The museum has to take possession of the property at least once during the 10-year period. And it must be used for the charity's exempt purposes. So if you give the painting to a museum, they got to be hanging it up in the museum because that's their purpose. If you don't comply with these rules, and you don't give the rest of the fractional interest to the museum within the 10 years, what happens is, assuming it's more than 3 years from the date that you gave the initial gift, you can't do an amended tax return because amended returns could only open for 3 years. Let's say you decide in year five, I decide I'm not to give this to the charity anymore, or you never let them hang in a museum, or whatever the circumstances are, you have to add back to your income that deduction that you got for that charity. And not only do you have to add it back to your income, but they're going to charge you a 10% penalty. And they're also going to charge you interest and penalty on the fact that you didn't pay the tax. And so if you're talking about 9 years later, it could be pretty stiff penalties and interest. So like I said, you want to have to give the gift. And this is not, well, I think I'll give it, let the museum maybe have it, and then 6 years from now saying, you know, I really love that Picasso, I want that back in my living room. So like I said, so that's the catch with this. You really have to want to give the gift, and you have to keep in mind that the gift is going to be limited to the fair market value when you gave the gift. This is another one which is, you know, what as I say, not such good news, where currently under the current law, if you give a cash contribution and it's more than $250, you need a letter, a canceled check, something to prove that you gave the gift. Well, they decided we're not going to just have that as a cutoff of $250 anymore. We're going to make it for all cash contributions. So you have to make sure that you write a check, you get a letter from the charity saying, you know, that you actually made this contribution. Where is this going to hurt? Like, I mean, like, let's say during its Christmas time, holiday times, and there's the Salvation Army, you know, kettle or bucket, whatever it is outside a department store. If you put a $20 bill in there, you really can't take that as a contribution anymore because, because I'm sure the guy dressed as Santa Claus is not going to be handing out tax receipts as you put the money into this bucket. Also, for people that, depending upon the religion, they might put money cash, you really need to write checks because, you know, if you're examined, they're going to say, where's the canceled check? Where's the receipt from the charity? I mean, I'm going to meet a lot of our clients when we do their tax returns, and I'll say, what are your contributions? And they say, well, I have letters for, you know, $40,000. Oh, but I got like $600 miscellaneous cash. And we put it on the tax return. We say, okay, fine, you gave $600 miscellaneous cash. Will not work anymore. If if you don't get audited, you don't examine, nothing will happen. But this is one area of the tax law contributions where people tend to be a little bit more, I don't know if I want to use the word aggressive, because you know, if you're a salaried employee and you don't have a business where you can take business deductions, this is one area where people say, oh, I must have given another couple $100. You know, someone came to my door, I handed them, you know, $10. They were collecting for the hard fund. But they want canceled checks, letters, receipts. Like I said, I went to a seminar that the IRS sponsors every year, and actually I'm going to it tomorrow. People were raising questions and about this and the next topic about the non-cash contributions. And he said, you know, he doesn't know if the examinations are going to be more on contributions, but this is the tax law and you're supposed to comply with it. Then there's the non-cash contributions, not marketable securities, because you get, when you give marketable securities to a charity, they give you a letter, they're saying thank you for your 100 shares of whatever. The value on the date of the contribution is $10,000, so you know you could take 30% of that. This is when people give, you know, clothing and other miscellaneous items. I'm sure everybody's heard of either Purple Heart or American Family Services or the ones that come right to your front door and you leave your bag out and they leave you a little receipt and you make up a number, you know, generally speaking. Theoretically, it was always supposed to be that whatever you put in those bags was supposed to be in good condition. Now they've written information into the tax law that you really have to, you know, state that it's at least in good condition and you're not just giving away a bunch of old socks. Because if it is stuff that you say is not in good condition, then you need to get a qualified appraisal if it's more than $500. How are they going to police this? I have no idea. One of the things that we discussed with the IRS person that was at the seminar not that long ago, I mean, I have clients that take pictures of every item that they give to the charities. I mean, I've been brought into my office a binder about, you know, this thick, and they've said, here's a picture of everything that I gave so that if I'm ever challenged, you can see, you know, it's in good condition. But like I said, people have to keep in mind that this is another area of the tax law where people have been a little aggressive because they say, oh, I gave 12 bags of clothing away. Oh, it must be worth at least $2,000. You know, my clothing's great. So this is one area where they might be looking more into trying to, you know, see, well, are these tax deductions valid tax deductions? The substantiation of the cash contributions, that doesn't end in 07. These are like forever, you know, and I doubt that they're going to go and change these laws. So this was, you know, just some of the provisions of the new tax bill that covered contributions that I wanted to cover this morning. There's a lot of other information in the bill. I mean, I have the actual book of the tax bill in my briefcase, which is this thick. If anybody would care to read it. but like I said, there are some incentives which are still good for this year. And we'll be, you know, watching the legislation closely to see if anything is going to change between now and the end of the year. And like I said, last year, bill passed December 22nd. So, you know, it's not an election year. So, you know, so that, you know, sometimes that makes a difference. But this is what I wanted to cover with you today.
The other big tax advantage in the Pension Protection Act was the new rules regarding S-corporation basis adjustments. This is one of those provisions that applies to, I wouldn't say a small number of people, but, you know, a fairly distinct group, but can have major implications. Here's a typical example of where you see it. Mrs. X is a small business owner, operates a personal service business as an S-corporation. For those of you, just a little bit of background, an S-corporation is a small business corporation. It's described in subchapter S of the Internal Revenue Code, which is why it's called an S-corporation. And it's a corporation that doesn't have entity-level tax. With your ordinary C-corporation, you have an entity-level tax. The corporation pays income tax on its taxable income. And then when it distributes dividends to the shareholders pay tax on the dividends. There's two layers of tax. An S-corporation is a pass-through entity, so that when the corporation earns income, the income is taxed to the shareholders. So that, and then when dividends are paid out, it's taken away from the previously taxed income, so that the shareholders are only paying tax on one layer of income. So it's a very attractive entity for small businesses, and there are certain rules regarding who can be an S-corporation shareholder and how many shareholders it can have, so that it remains for small businesses, although you see S-corporations with $20, $30 million capitalizations fairly routinely. So Mrs. S is a small business owner, operates a business as an S-corporation. The primary hard asset of the business is an office building, and the office building has a tax basis of $500,000 and a fair market value of $1 million. Tax basis meaning she paid $500,000, ignoring things like depreciation that can impact your basis. We'll just say it's a cost basis of $500,000. That's previously taxed income that's been put into the building that under ordinary kind of income tax rules, we don't tax again. So that when you sell the property, if she were to sell the property for $1 million, she would have $500,000 of capital gain on which she'd have to pay tax. In the coming years, Mrs. X is looking to retire and is concerned because her estate is currently taxable. So that if she were to distribute the building out to herself, she now has a $1 million asset in her estate. And if it's taxable, that's a 45% flat federal estate tax. She also has an interest in making a substantial charitable gift to her alma mater, University Y. Very creative with the names here. Mrs. X's stock, the stock has its own basis of $500,000, $5,000 per share, and a fair market value of $1 million. The numbers add up very easily here because I don't like arithmetic. The question is, she wants to make this charitable donation. Should she contribute her stock in the S-corporation, or should the S-corporation contribute the building? under previous law, the clear answer was stock because of the rules for charitable donations of appreciated property. If you donate to a public charity, and a little later we'll get into the distinction between public charities and private foundation, but if you donate to a public charity, you get a deduction to the extent of 50% of your adjusted gross income, which Ruth was talking about, and the deduction will include the fair market value of property contributed. So that if I paid $500,000 for my stock and I donate it to a public charity and it's worth $1 million, I get a $1 million deduction and I never pay tax on that $500,000 of gain. Get this full reduction of your taxable estate because there's an unlimited charitable deduction for both gift tax and estate tax purposes, and full gift tax charitable deduction, so that $500,000 of gain is effectively sheltered from any tax whatsoever. However, there are a lot of downsides to contributing stock. The first is that charities often don't like to get S corporation stock as donations because charities are taxed on the income that they receive from S corporation stock. It's called unrelated business taxable income. And the way an S corporation works is as the corporation earns income, it's recognized by the shareholders. It's called their distributive share of income. So if I own 100% of an S corporation and the corporation earns $100, I have $100 of income in that year. All of the income passing through to a charitable owner of S corporation stock is taxable to them. Even though they're a tax-exempt entity, there's an exception for this unrelated business income, and any S corporation income is considered an unrelated business. The second is loss of control. To the extent that Mrs. X wants to remain in the business for a few more years, wants to ease out, she now has another shareholder to deal with that has its own needs, requirements, and if she contributes all of her stock, well, now she's lost control of the business entirely, even if she remains on as an employee. Now the stock is owned by this charity. So not all business owners want to take out another shareholder in the interest of making a charitable gift. Possible discounts of deductible value. There are some people who say, all right, I don't want to give up control, so what I'll do is I'll issue non-voting S corporation stock, which is permitted, and I'll contribute the non-voting stock to the charity, and I'll retain one share of voting stock, the only share of voting stock. Problem is that non-voting stock is not worth the fair market value of the underlying assets. You have to discount it for the fact that it's non-voting. Similarly, if you decide, I'll just give a minority interest in the business so I retain control, you have to deduct the value of the stock for the fact that it's a minority interest and that you don't have control over the corporation. That reduces the value of your charitable deduction. Fourth is possible reciprocal benefit issues. It's, I would say, 90% certain that if you remain on as an employee of an S corporation after donating the stock, you will get a full deduction for the stock. But there is that, I would say, 10% chance, and these are not exact numbers, that the IRS could come in and say, wait a second, you've donated stock, and in return, you're getting a salary as an employee. We're going to reduce the value of your deduction by the amount of salary that you're receiving. Just like if you buy a charitable raffle ticket, you don't get a full deduction. You have to reduce your deduction by the value of the raffle ticket. So that is a possible issue. Generally, the IRS has held that where salary is reasonable, that's not going to be an issue. But those are private letter rulings. They're not binding on the service. And you just never know. There's a risk there. The problem is that there was no real good alternative if you wanted to give gifts of S corporation assets prior to 2007 and after 2007. This is one of those one-year provisions. Because you have to, when an S corporation made a charitable donation, all deductions passing through an S corporation, just like income passes through an S corporation, deductions do as well. If the S corporation loses money in a year, then that loss is passed through the S corporation so that the shareholder can use it to offset income on their return. But deductions from passing through an S corporation are limited to your basis in the S corporation stock. So you reduce the S corporation basis by the amount of pass-through deduction, and the deductions passed through are limited. In our prior example, we have a $1 million building with a $500,000 basis and a $500,000 basis in the stock. When you donate the building, the S corporation has a $1 million deduction. When it comes through, though, the shareholder can only recognize $500,000 of that deduction. So the problem is that you don't shelter that additional $500,000 of gain, that $500,000 of gain is not deducted. Obviously, since you're retaining the stock, if the corporation continues making money and you eventually want to get rid of that S corporation stock, there's the potential that you could recognize that that $500,000 if the value of the stock goes back up. But it's reducing your deduction substantially. What the Pension Protection Act did in 2007 is it said, when an S corporation makes a contribution of property, you will only reduce basis by the inside basis in the property, by the S corporation's basis in the property. So that in the prior example, the S corporation donates a $1 million building. The $1 million deduction passes through to the shareholder, and basis of the shareholder is only reduced by $500,000. So that effectively, you get the full $1 million deduction as a shareholder. Rather than passing through $1 million as far as the basis reduction in the S corporation stock, only $500,000 of the deduction reduces basis, and the remainder, the whole $1 million comes through as a deduction. So that basically all this does is it gives parity between a donation of the property and a donation of the stock. But you don't have all the problems attendant to the donation of the stock. So that's the big benefit in 2007. And like I said, this is a fairly esoteric issue, but it comes up. And I've had it actually come up with a few different clients. So I thought it was worth discussing and mentioning, particularly because it can, if you are one of these people in this situation, have tremendous benefits. So that's the Pension Protection Act. But we figured that while we had you here, we would discuss some more traditional, tried and true methods of charitable giving that can have very substantial benefits. And the first of these is a charitable remainder trust. The way charitable remainder trust works is as follows. The grantor, the donor, transfers property to a trust. They retain an interest in the trust, either for life or for a term of years. And it has to be either a qualified annuity interest or a qualified unit trust interest, which we'll discuss in a minute. But what it is is the property will continue to pay them out during the term of the trust. And at the end of the trust, often at the end of the donor's lifetime, the property goes to a designated charity. The advantages are substantial. You get a current income tax deduction for the value of the remainder interest. The remainder interest is determined using IRS actuarial and mortality tables, so that they determine the present value today of an interest at the end of your expected life expectancy or at the end of the term of years. If you say 10 years, they'll say, all right, well, what's the value of this property after 10 years? You get a current gift tax deduction. There's no gift tax assessed because the property is ultimately payable to a charity, which qualifies for the unlimited charitable deduction from the gift tax. You get continued use of the property. You deduct value in the property today and continue to use it for either the rest of your life or for the rest of the term of years that you want to retain it for. And the fact is that the fact that the charitable remainder trust itself is tax exempt provides some opportunities for income tax planning to reduce your taxable income along the way. So like I said, the retained interest has to be either a unit trust or an annuity interest. And the charitable remainder unit trust is often referred to as a CRUT, and a charitable remainder annuity trust is referred to as a CRET. The way a CRUT works is that each year during the trust term, the grantor is paid a fixed percentage of the current value of the assets. So you would retain 10% of the value of the trust assets valued annually. This is good because it keeps up with inflation. If the property is appreciating, your interest will likewise appreciate. A CRUT also offers certain benefits that a CRAT does not. You can add to a CRUT during the term of the CRUT. You can't do that with a CRAT. A CRAT has you paid an annuity, so that it's a fixed dollar amount that you determine on day one. Every year, grantor will be paid $50,000 out of the trust. And it doesn't matter if the trust assets go down in value. It doesn't matter if they go up in value. It doesn't matter if that is your fixed annuity interest. I have here a little chart showing when you might choose a CRUT versus a CRAT, depending on the grantor's wishes. Generally, a CRUT will provide for maximum payout. Whether you do a CRAT or a CRUT, your remainder interest has to be worth at least 10% of the property contributed. And the IRS gives complex regulations for telling you how to value that as far as how you get the 10%. There's computer programs that do it too. So you can determine your CRUT if you want maximum use of the property, but to still get this charitable deduction and also to make use of the income tax planning devices that I'll discuss. You can retain a CRUT, determine what unit trust interest, the maximum interest that will allow the remainder interest to be valued at 10% on day one. And it will give you, that's the maximum amount that you can possibly take out of a charitable remainder trust if the property is appreciating. Property is going down, obviously your amount that you take out every year will be less and less, so that if you are putting in appreciating assets, which is ordinarily the case, and you want the maximum payout, CRUD is your best opportunity. If you have appreciating assets and you want the maximum deduction, a CRAD is the best opportunity because it's not going to increase as the value of the assets increases. You determine your annuity interest, which I believe has to be at least 5% of the value of the property when you put it in. And as the assets appreciate, you're still only getting 5% of that original amount. And that's taken into account when the value of the remainder interest is determined using the IRS table, so that you can get a larger upfront charitable deduction because you're taking out less money. If you have depreciating assets and you want the maximum payout, a CRAD is also your best opportunity because the value of your interest will not decrease with the value of the assets. So that's something to bear in mind. It's rare that you see somebody actually contributing assets that they know to be depreciating to a charitable remainder trust, but it happens. And in that event, I would definitely recommend a charitable remainder annuity trust. Like I've mentioned, the IRS actuarial and mortality tables determine the value. The nice thing about charitable remainder trusts, I'm not going to be discussing charitable lead trusts today, but I will mention that this is not true of charitable lead trusts, which are not tax exempt, is that the charitable remainder trust is itself a tax exempt entity. And what that means is that if you put appreciating property into a tax exempt, or appreciated property into a charitable remainder trust, and the trust sells the property, that capital gain is suspended inside the trust, and you don't have to pay tax on its value immediately. Give you an example. You have an individual who owns stock who knows that there is a tender offer in place and knows that the board is going to vote on whether to accept the tender offer in 3 months. Prior to the board's voting, he decides to contribute his stock to a charitable remainder trust. Charitable remainder trust holds the stock at one value. The stock appreciates after the vote by 20%. And the charitable trust sells the stock. That capital gain is not recognized immediately. Now, in that year, the proceeds are reinvested in other securities that give off whatever income they give off. At the end of the year, charitable benefit or grantor gets his interest out. Say it's 10% interest. He gets his 10% interest paid to him. First, that's ordinary income to the extent that the reinvested proceeds have generated ordinary income. So first, the amount that he receives will first be characterized of his ordinary income to the extent of any ordinary income in the trust. Only then will he start to take out capital gain. If the ordinary income makes up his entire interest, then that capital gain isn't paid that year, and that tax is suspended. You're still earning money on the capital gains tax that would have otherwise been paid. You have to pay tax on the money that's earned on it, but you don't have to pay tax on that initial capital gain amount until such time as it's distributed. So here we have an example. Stock worth $250,000 is contributed to a CRUT with an 11.25% unit trust interest. The remainder on the date of grant is worth $25,000, so we have maximum payout here. February 1, the trust sells the stock, generating $250,000 in capital gain. Reinvest the proceeds, and the new investments generate interest of $28,145, which is the amount distributed in 2007. So in 2007, none of the capital gain on the sale is recognized. And if the property continues to perform as well as that, which is unlikely, but if you continue to generate enough ordinary income on these capital gain to make up the entire unit trust interest, you may never pay capital gains tax on that. Capital gain is carried forward. So that is a straight income tax benefit from a charitable remainder unit trust. And you can probably come up with numbers where, notwithstanding the general rule that you always have to have a charitable intent, you can probably come up with numbers with these where if it came out, you may actually make money on it. It's rare. You'd have to get a really good return on the investments, and you'd have to have everything mesh perfectly. But there are situations that you can come up with where you end up saving $40,000 in tax for the cost of a $25,000 remainder interest, which is a good deal. So that's charitable remainder trust. Does anybody have any questions on charitable remainder trusts? Yes.
Mike, when you create a trust for a donor, who do you recommend to be the trustee? Are there any advantages or disadvantages to name a trustee? It's normally the nonprofit who's the trustee.
Yeah, ordinarily you would have the nonprofit be the trustee, not necessarily, depending on what kind of nonprofit it is. A lot of times universities like to be the trustees of their trust. They like to use their documents. You can have a commercial trust company be the trustee. You can name a non-professional as a trustee. There's nothing wrong with that. But especially if you're dealing with a unit trust that requires annual valuations, that can be a difficult task, being trustee. A lot of times, even if you are going to have an individual be your trustee, you'll want an institutional trustee to be co-trustee, just to deal with all of the administrative burdens of acting as trustee of a charitable remainder trust. And like I said, a lot of the larger public charities also serve as trustee of these things. The other area I'd like to discuss is private foundations. We've alluded to it a couple of times over the course of the presentation, the difference between a public charity and a private foundation. And without getting too technical, a public charity is generally one that is public. It's supported by the public. It does things. University is a public charity most of the time. The Red Cross is a public charity. The United Way is a public charity. Bigger charities in general, charities that undertake actions. A private foundation, and there are private operating foundations, but the type of private foundation that I'm mainly talking about here is a personal nonprofit organization that one donor will set up, probably a family foundation, that will be its own exempt entity. Just like the Red Cross, it is a 501c3 entity. But all that it does is it collects money and it distributes money to public charities. The benefits of a private foundation are substantial. Number one, you get both income tax and estate tax deductions for putting money into your own control. You retain control over the investments. You can have it be multi-generational so that your descendants are retaining control over these investments and over where the money's going. It allows for family giving. It allows for all these kind of non-tax benefits of being able to continue your giving in an active sense. It's one of the only ways that you can deduct something from your estate, and there are other ways, but it's one of the only ways that you can deduct an amount of money from your estate and retain control and have your descendants retain control over those funds. The deductions are slightly reduced than from a public charity. As Ruth mentioned, you can deduct up to 50% of your adjusted gross income to a public charity. To a private foundation, it's limited to 30%. You can also only deduct the basis of appreciated property. So that in our example with the building worth $1 million with a $500,000 basis, if you donate it to your private foundation, you're only going to get a $500,000 deduction. The exception to that is publicly traded securities. If most of your wealth is in publicly traded stock, you can get a full deduction for that. Those deductions are limited to 20% of your adjusted gross income for appreciated property. For estate tax purposes, you get a full deduction. So often see bequests to private foundations and wills because you're going to get a full charitable deduction, get it out of your estate for tax purposes, but still have your beneficiaries or whoever you have in charge of the foundation controlling the charitable disposition of the proceeds. Likewise, it's a full gift tax deduction so that when you make a gift, you don't have to pay gift tax on it. Because these are so attractive, there were a lot of abuses. The primary one was looting the private foundation, essentially. The big abuse was, and I like to talk about the abuse because for so much of tax law, and especially in this area, the easiest way to understand the rules is to understand what they're trying to prevent. The biggest abuse was, great, I'll leave all my assets to a private foundation and I won't pay estate tax on them, and the private foundation will pay a $3 million per year salary to each of its trustees who happen to be the people I wanted to leave money to. And it's a way of getting money to your beneficiaries tax-free. So what the government has done is they've made very strict distribution requirements on the foundation and very strict excise taxes on any kind of self-dealing, which we'll discuss. Any investment income that the foundation has in any year, they have to pay 2% flat tax on. That's not punitive, that's just all the way. It's not a fully exempt organization. You still have this 2% tax on net investment income. Self-dealing. Self-dealing is any payment to a disqualified person. And a disqualified person is any family member, any trustee or officer of the foundation, any family member of a trustee or officer of the foundation, any governmental person. It's also, primarily they're focused on the family members of the trustees. Now you can pay salary for administrative acts to run the foundation. So you know, even with the $3 million example, if somebody's really the administrator of a $16 billion foundation, that may be justified and that may be okay under the rules. Again, there's no hard and fast rule. The service has been very strict about what constitutes running the foundation so that you can't pay yourself a salary to do a charitable act in furtherance of the foundation's mission. Generally, the only things they allow salary for are administration, accounting services, legal services, things that deal with the running of the foundation rather than the charitable activities of the foundation, which is a fine and sometimes non-existent line that you have to tread. Foundation also has to distribute 5% of the fair market value of its assets per year to public charities. They also don't want private foundations running businesses, so they're limited. They can't hold more than 20% of the voting stock in any business corporation. There is an exception for what they call qualifying investments, which are corporations that are essentially charitable, even if they're not exempt. It's rare to see a qualifying investment, but they do allow investment in things like community action organizations and things like that. And taxable expenditures. Private foundation will have to pay tax on certain amounts that are not considered to be within its exempt purpose. These include any kind of influencing the outcome of an election, as a grant to an individual for travel, study, or other similar purposes. That's not absolute. You can give grants as a private foundation to individuals, but the IRS has to specifically approve your grant-making procedures. And there's an application for IRS approval for grant-making procedures. As a grant to any organization, unless it's a charitable operating organization, which includes private operating foundations and public charities, or the foundation exercises expenditure responsibility with respect to the grant. And that's requiring extensive reporting from the charitable beneficiary on how exactly they're spending the money and making sure that you are not losing control over that investment. This actually applies to all the charitable donations that we've discussed today. We have the 50% of AGI limitation, the 30% for capital gain property limitation, and obviously those are 30 and 20 for private foundations. But one thing we didn't discuss is the percentage limitations. There's a phase-out of the charitable deduction depending on adjusted gross income, so that you reduce your charitable deduction by, and nobody's going to remember this, it's 2/3 multiplied by the lesser of 3% of the AGI of the adjusted gross income to the extent that it exceeds $156,400 or 80% of your itemized deductions. Just something to be aware of, that there are these percentage limitations and that when you are calculating your charitable deduction for charitable gift, that you have to be attuned to what the adjusted gross income is and the extent to which those deductions are claimable. And you can carry forward unused deduction. Does anybody have any questions? Yes.
The 20% that you referred to as the voting stock, I guess clarification is you hear these corporations like Hewlett-Packard, Walmart, and the families have, the foundation can consist of more than, their assets can be more than 20% of the stock in a single corporation, but it's if they control 20% of the voting of that corporation?
Correct. It's voting
okay,
stock.
Okay, so because again, you hear about these concentrated positions.
Yes.
Hewlett-Packard
yes.
being famous.
Right.
For that. Okay.
Right. That is voting stock. That's correct. Anything else?
Is there a minimum amount involved with the private foundation, either relative to value or assets or income?
As far as when it pays to set one up or whether you need to capitalize it with a certain amount of money? Yeah, I mean, there's no requirement. You can set up a private foundation for $5. Ultimately, it probably doesn't pay to do for less than $1 million because of the expense involved in getting IRS recognition of exempt status, the administrative burden of having to make your distributions every year, value the assets every year, determine charitable beneficiaries every year. I mean, there's a lot of expense and cost that go into it so that at the end of the day, you probably want a fairly substantial amount of money in there to make it worthwhile.
I just wanted to add, there's other tax reporting requirements. If you
That's
set
right.
up a private foundation, annually you have to file what they call Form 990 PF. So unless you know you feel you're qualified to do that, then you have to hire somebody to do that tax return. And you have to have books and records, and you have to keep track of all these contributions. So I think, you know, generally speaking, we hear $1 million.
It's
like generally the smallest amount that we would tell a client to contribute.
Well, yeah, we often
right, yeah.
have people set up private foundations with minimal capitalization. They don't want to part with the money yet, but they want to leave the money in their will to the private foundation. You give up the income tax deduction when you do it that way, but you still get the estate tax deduction, which is probably, you know, the more significant benefit, just because the estate tax is so much higher. All right, well, thank you all for coming. I hope you have enjoyed it and learned something, or one or both of those. And we'll be around for a little while afterwards if people have individual questions they want to ask.
That concludes our program for this podcast. If you have comments or suggestions about these programs, you can share an audio comment on our podcast comment line by calling area code 206-333-1263. That's 206-333-1263. You can also send an MP3 audio file by email to info@professionalpodcasts.com. For more information, please visit flastergreenberg.com or isdanerllc.com. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts LLC in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. This is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.